Okay, I'm Howard Hudson, editor at UNU Merit, and I'm joined by Zina Nime, who's a Jordanian researcher at the School of Governance. Obviously, we're looking at the recent revolutions which have been spreading across North Africa and Middle East. So just first question really is can you tell me about the origins of it all in terms of the economics and politics of the region?
Yes, thanks, Howard. What is on paper as what started everything, if you Google all of that, is probably the incidents of Bouazizi, the young man who set himself on fire in Tunisia and sparked what was the wave of revolutions in what is happening in the Middle East. I think, although this is sort of a symbolic beginning of it, it lies much deeper, and it's an issue that has been brewing for a very long time. The Bouazizi case in Tunisia, and of course there was a lot in the media going on, is that, oh, there's more self-immolation taking place in other Arab countries. However, what was specific about the case of Tunisia wasn't necessarily the case in Egypt. And in Egypt, I would say it actually started much earlier than that, with the Khaled Saeed incident, who was also a young man who was arrested at a cyber cafe in Alexandria in June
2010.
Yes. Yeah. And it was said that he died of asphyxia, and then it was later found out that he was actually tortured and beaten to death, and the images came out. And they were very graphic, and they really had a big impact on the people. And of course, it's not just the Khaled Saeed incident, but it even goes to before that. If you look at the April 6th movement in Egypt, which goes back to 2008, which was a reaction of protests that were taking place in an industrial area in Egypt named the Mahalla. What all of this is saying is that this has been a brewing thing, mm-hmm. and it has taken a long time. And what Tunis represents is the sparks, and then it unfolded in Egypt.
But what's so different about Egypt, I mean, specifically? And why didn't, you know, the murder of Khaled Saeed bring the revolution in Egypt 6 months previously?
That's a very good question, and I think that this is why Tunisia was so important. There was a very interesting saying that was circulating in the blogs during the Egyptian revolution, that yesterday we were all Tunisia and today we are all Egypt. I think people needed to see that it could really happen. And that's my personal opinion, that seeing that what the Tunisians were able to accomplish, and by Zain al-Abidine bin Ali leaving office, I think people were shocked that they could even do it. And even in Egypt, at the beginning, people did not expect that Mubarak would actually eventually be ousted. People really wanted reform. The beauty about these revolutions were that they had no political motive to begin with. Mm-hmm. They were really about the youth wanting a better life. As simple as that.
But it was also the middle class and youth as well, wasn't it?
Definitely the middle class were the catalyst. And definitely the whole digital, I would say the digital identity of this age was a catalyst. And definitely all of these things made it possible. For example, in Egypt, when the internet was cut off for, I think, about a week or 10 days, yeah. I mean, things did not stop. They continued and they actually even grew. And yes, there is this argument that it was also dependent on some satellite TV stations, etc. But it was sort of the hair that broke the camel's back, as they say.
Okay. So who's next then? Libya, Yemen, Algeria?
Yeah, that's I think the question that is on the minds of everyone. Yeah. Definitely, Libya is the most likely. I think, and again, that's my personal analysis of the situation, is that the Arab countries realized, to varying degrees, that they have a common plight, which is these autocratic leaders that are in control. And the gap that was coming too mind-boggling between those who have and those who don't have was just ridiculous. However, the point is that these leaders have lost any legitimacy that mm-hmm. they claim to have to rule these people. Their leadership was no longer about the country or the people. It wasn't even a leadership, it was self-interests.
So what's the next step in terms of what potential democratic model these countries could follow, whether they could follow the example of Turkey, or whether, in a worst-case scenario, potentially following the Iranian model?
Well, you can't really consider the Iranian model as a democratic model. So this and what happened in Iran was a completely different case altogether. So putting that aside, the Turkish model, and many have been saying, oh, well, the Arab world follow the Turkish model, especially with the current the party that is in power, which in its older versions was very similar to what we see today as the Muslim Brothers. And they actually have shown successfully how they can maintain a secular state while keeping a party that has religious identity. But my problem with this is that we're always trying to find previous models to explain what's going to be happening in the future. And of course, this is our role in trying to do our academic analysis. But the way I look at it, I think that it is not going to follow a model. I think all of these countries will create their own model. And I think that it is going to be up to the people.
Are you saying that you don't think Western-style democracy is possible by definition in these countries?
No, I'm not saying that. And actually, I would maybe even go back to say to you, what is Western-style democracy? I mean, if Western-style democracy in its initial sense was that the people are represented and those who are in power take their legitimacy out of the power that is entrusted to them by the people, I don't see why not. The Arab world, you are talking about 340 million in population. You're talking about multiple ethnicities. And yes, Arabs and Muslims are the majority, but you have many religions as well. Maybe sects of religions, if you want to call them, but you have several religions. You have many ethnicities. You have, for example, the Berbers, you have the Kurds in the northern regions of Iraq and Syria, you have the Nubians in the northern Sudan and southern Egypt.
Yeah.
So each country is going to be so specific in how it's going to form its own democratic model, if you want to call it. But in so far that it is about the people having a say in their life, which became non-existent in the past few years. In that sense, no, I don't think it's the Arab world has a problem in adopting a Western-style democracy.
In terms of personalities, we heard a lot of talk from Mohammed al-Baradei previously, but since the revolution actually achieved its first objective to remove Mubarak, I haven't heard anything from him. Is there a reason for that?
I mean, he has said that it's, I mean, he's been more, I think, behind the scenes. And I think he has said it is the people who should be speaking. I think Radi has been a very major catalyst in what has happening. And I think his appearance on the scene has been, several years ago, has been the push behind the youth. Mm-hmm. And this is by statements and testimony from many of the youth themselves. I think that we will be seeing more of him. Mm-hmm. And I think that he's the one that I would say is more doing the more sophisticated political moves, if you want. I think he even talks a talk internationally much more than internally. And maybe this has actually been his criticism. But having the Baradei on board or not, even for the United States, I mean, if you look at how the United States have dealt with many of the of what was happening, even in Tunisia and then in Egypt and maybe now they're being more assertive to an extent in Libya. Mm-hmm. But you can see at the very beginning, they were so caught between their loyalty to their ally, to Mubarak, and then the fear of Islamism taking over, and then also their desire to be on the right side of history. And you can see that they gradually distance themselves from Mubarak. Yes, they are a very important element in the formula, but they are not... It is really about the people.
Yeah, it wasn't surrounding al-Baradei. He was one
player.
I would
say he was a catalyst. Yeah. I would say more than just a player. I think he was a catalyst, but I think that it was also about the millions of people that were, you know, not to sound so emotional, but they were literally risking their lives to be there and to say enough is enough.
And Egypt is 80 million?
80 million.
Which is about the same size as Germany and Europe.
And I mean, to think of, you know, the Tahrir Square, those who have been to Tahrir Square, to it to being, you know, suffocating because it was so crowded. You can imagine the enormous amounts of people that were there. And you could see it on, I mean, how it was broadcasted.
So what's the role of the international community now?
My opinion is that the international community should focus more on its interdependent role as opposed to its imposing role or it's setting, telling these countries what to do. On one angle, I would say, yes, in the sense we can provide help if help is needed, but this is your thing and you have to figure it out for yourself. But on another more pragmatic sense, I think that the international community needs to, and especially in Europe, I think there has to be an important consideration for the migrants. I think that there has to be a concentrated effort in strengthening the roles of international organizations in relation to migration, just like other treaties that you have with these countries.
What do you mean in practical terms?
I think that the economic forces for migration are extremely strong. And I think that the European population in particular, as it is aging and you having this graying phenomena, I think that Europe has to consider what type of strategy it's going to take, because you're talking about 60% of a population that is below the age of 25. So unless you can, you know, ignore the elephant in the room and say that's not going to be an issue, but this will be an issue. And instead of it becoming a problematic issue, I think Europe has to be very avant-garde and strategic in looking at this issue. Of course, keeping in mind, and I stress that, keeping in mind the cultural and social issues that need to be handled. But I think from an economic perspective, I think that it is very important to take that into consideration.
Okay, thank you very much.